Hi, welcome to the Art of Business podcast. My name is Tim Lebrecht. I'm a co-founder of the House of Beautiful Business. We are here in Davos at the World Economic Forum Annual Meeting 2023. And we are broadcasting, or rather recording, from the Heimat Museum, the Museum of the Home. It's a really beautiful, very wooden kind of cabin. With me is Dr. Ulrike Handel. Dr. Ulrike Handel, and we'll talk about your professional biography in a second, but you just told me you grew up in southern Germany, so you said this reminds you of your home, of your childhood.
My home, yeah. It looks very much like the southern part of Germany, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, it's in Graubünden, but it could also be in the Black Forest, I guess, or in Swabia, where I'm from.
Yeah.
So really wonderful to have you here, Ulrike. Ulrike has extensive experience, more than 25 years, 30 years in the digital economy, particularly in media. You worked for at Pepper in advertising. You were CEO for Dentsu, the big advertising conglomerate with responsibility for Germany, then DACH, all the German-speaking countries, and then EMEA, parts of EMEA as well. You held several managerial positions at Axel Springer Publisher, which is Europe's largest publisher. Is that still the case? Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be the world's largest publisher because they acquired Politico and Insider in the US. So they are growing very fast.
That's right. And then you returned to Springer and served on the board responsible for news media Europe and for marketing media.
Exactly.
If I get that right, for 7 months and then left this past December. So a lot to talk about. This is not your first Davos, I suppose. You've been here many times.
Yes.
And so people always talk about these Davos moments.
Yeah.
What have been some of your Davos moments so far this year? What stood out for you?
Yeah. So I just arrived yesterday with, to be honest, first day, no plan. And I just bumped into lots of interesting people and gathered, as always, lots of business cards with people I know I will keep the contact forever, and had a lot of new ideas. So, and I also met with my former colleagues from Politico. They had a cocktail night last night. I met a lot of my media peers at the Buda DLD nightcap. So I got to bed very, very late. So a very short night, but that's what Davos is all about. Try to get as much out of it.
Yeah, I was talking to an investor last night in the queue to one of the parties, and I asked her, what brings you to Davos? And her answer was great. She just said, everything.
Yeah.
And what is different, though, having been to Davos many times? Is it different? Does it feel different now in a post-pandemic era that's also really eclipsed still by the ongoing war in Ukraine? Or is it more or less the same vibe that you've always encountered?
So in my eyes, it's more or less the same vibe. Everybody is just very happy to meet in person. So I have the feeling there are even more people than before. Also, everything outside the usual conference center is really, really active. All the big companies are here. So the promenade is kind of a pop-up store lane. It's really, really interesting. Blockchain and Web3 is still there. It's not that as many people think or try to discuss. It's very vital. That's something which is really interesting. And also, of course, the Ukraine is here.
Right on Web 3.0, because I had the exact same impression. I thought, wow, it's really they're actually quite resilient. There's lots of companies. There's a lot of talk about crypto and Web 3.0.
Yes.
What are you seeing here? What are some of the main trends there? And how big of a believer are you in Web 3.0 as the next big digital paradigm?
Yeah. So to sum it up, I have no clue about Web3, and that's the reason why I put a lot of personal money in order to force myself to follow the path, because I'm convinced. I work in the digital media space since 30 years, and I'm convinced that Web3 is the next infrastructure of our whole industry. So something will happen, and therefore, I need to be there. I missed the Web 2. I missed the Web 1. I was too late, and I want to be in the middle of Web 3. There's a lot of risk. There's a lot of bets. But I think the right people are there in the place. And when I talk about Web 3, I don't talk about coins. I really talk about the infrastructure, which will be the foundation, the tech foundation of the future, business and industries.
Can you share some of the projects or the startups you invested in, and the type of work or the type of projects they're working on?
I invested in two funds, which are running quite well, don't have coins. And I'm currently talking to the founder of Ethermail, and he is building an email infrastructure for the Web3. So this is something today, just imagine you have an email address, but you can't share a wallet with this email address. So we need a completely new kind of communication infrastructure. And this entrepreneur is building with Ethermail this kind of infrastructure. Of course, there are competitors. You never know how many infrastructures will be in the future, who wins, who will be big, who will grow exponential. But this is perfectly the space where you should be in, I think.
We both were attending a panel earlier today about diversity in Web 3.0, yeah. And Jessica Apotheker, the CMO of BCG, shared some research. And if I remember the numbers correctly, she said that 7% of all female founder teams in Web 3.0 only get funding. And then in the third round of funding, 0% actually. So quite shocking numbers.
Yeah.
So what do you think needs to be done and to make sure that we have a much better representation and more diversity now in terms of the founders and the people shaping this new paradigm?
Yeah, I think Web3 as a technology space is a typical male space still. So society is developing, there are more and more female founders and also female IT specialists growing, but still it's very male-driven. What we can do is, of course, there are so many opportunities to join this new space. So, for example, you can go in a board as a female in order, and that's what I, for example, keen on doing in order to share your experience with those founders from another industry and help them to grow. So I think it's, in the end also, it's a duty of the investors to value diversity, because I'm just sure that diverse teams are better. So there's also better financial impact. So just look where you put your money. You have a lot of power as an investor, so you can put your money on diverse teams or at least force teams to get more diverse. It's very easy.
So on the one hand, Web 3.0 comes with the promise of being more inclusive, more democratic, more accessible,
yeah.
Right? So sovereign data,
yeah.
You own your data, you determine your fortune, which is all great. But on the other hand, I can totally relate to what you said earlier. The space is so cryptic and the language is so opaque and it's so hard to crack somehow. If I read papers about it, I kind of check out after a page. So there's also
yeah.
a new divide that's happening of those who really get it and they're sort of insiders and those who are already like
yeah.
no longer following.
Yeah.
So this brings me to the power and responsibility
yeah.
of media.
Yeah.
Like what, I feel like this is not, there's sort of business media following all the deals, but I'm not sure that media, broadly speaking, mainstream media has done a good job of really explaining what it is. Would you agree or what's your view on this?
Explaining Web3?
Yeah.
I think it gets better, but of course, the media first need to understand what Web3 is. And it's still highly complex. And sometimes even those who work in Web3 are not really good in explaining. And sometimes I have also the feeling they really don't understand it. So it's still a very early era. It's still not a very mature industry. So I think the power of the media here is just to ask questions, ask it again, and try to sum it up in a language that everybody understands it, but also show when there is no knowledge behind. So if there is a project which perhaps doesn't make sense or someone is just throwing around with buzzwords, that's, in my eyes, the power of media to reveal that, to go deeper, to do research, to see if it's real, if there's a chance or not. Mm. Telling the truth in the end, questioning the status. Mm.
The rise of the decentralized web is something that people are quite excited about. But the theme of Davos this year is cooperation in
yes.
a fragmented world,
yeah.
which is kind of the flip side of decentralization.
Yeah.
And first I read it and thought, oh, wow, fragmented, that sounds horrible. That's really a bad thing. And then I thought, well, maybe is it? Or is it actually something positive? Like, what does it trigger in you, the term fragmented? What do you make of it? What does it mean to live in a fragmented world?
Yeah, to be honest, it reminds me of my dissertation, because the title of my dissertation was The Fragmentation of the Media Audience. And it was an empiric study where I have examined how the more and more diverse media landscape is hurting democracy because people are using different media and are not able to talk about anymore. And also for information, there is no medium which informs everybody. So you need to take to use many, many channels. And my dissertation was done in the 90s. So when we talk about a fragmentation of media in the 90s, there was no internet yet. And even then, everybody was crying, oh my God, democracy is down. So that was my first thinking when I heard collaboration in a fragmented world. To be very honest, I think this title would fit in every year. Mm-hmm. It's nothing special. Mm-hmm. First I thought, didn't they have another idea? But of course, everybody's trying to use this title, and we are in a polarized world currently. There's more and more nationalism, and even within countries, look at Germany, there are small, very vocal groups stating their opinion, so almost aggressive. So the fragmentation is everywhere. And I think it's a good thing also always to be optimistic and to say, collaborate, because together you are stronger within a country, within a region, within Europe and within the world.
So so let's use the term polarization. Yeah. That's something that's been written and talked about a lot, and the role of media in either overcoming the polarization or actually furthering the divide. And we've seen in the US in particular with Fox Network and Murdoch Media on the one hand, and you know then other more liberal yeah. media really like almost like it's becoming more extreme, and they're catering yeah. to very different audiences.
Yes.
Would you say that's similar in Germany? How would you compare the German-speaking media landscape to that? And then in particular, Springer, of course, which publishes Welt, daily newspaper, and of course, Bild, which is the largest newspaper by circulation in Europe. And very, you know, very agenda-setting, of course, for large swaths of the population.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how would you compare the German media landscape to it? And there's money to be made in polarizing, yeah. right, for media.
Yes. I mean, the media landscape today is the most diverse media landscape we can have. And that's a big, big gift for everybody. So you can get information everywhere. On every channel, there are new brands arising. There are influencers who carry the information. And I think that's really something great in Germany, especially in Germany. And we have many very, very good quality media also. So a free and independent press, I think it's vital for democracy. It's also vital for getting informed. And that's absolutely there. I mean, the issue is more, I would say, the media literacy of the audience, and the channels and media are growing faster and polarizing, perhaps fragmenting faster than we are good in understanding and looking behind. So I am a big fan of media literacy already in the kindergarten and then in the primary school and further on, because it's part of our basic knowledge in order to understand the world and also to get a transparency on how the media business model works. On the other side, of course, it's also the responsibility of the media itself. But today I would always say everybody has an individual media menu, because my menu is different to your menu. Perhaps there is no overlap, but we have enough to discuss together because we get the same message on another channel through another source. So there is still a lot in common in order to foster democracy, in order to foster discussion, in order to get informed. You don't need to use certain channels or certain media. And I think it's a great thing also, like Axel Springer with Bild, which is the most powerful newspaper, in explaining everybody in simple words what the world is about. So I would say it's the only medium who is responsible for explaining also things like the climate issue, or also Web3, but also politics. So many other medias are already too complicated. So, and I think the media spectrum in Germany, from the left to the right and special interests, it's really, really big. So everything is there. You even get it for free sometimes. But you need to have the knowledge how to use it and how to value it. And that's what I mean with media literacy.
Mm-hmm. What about social media? So Twitter's train wreck ever since Elon Musk took over. Some people say, yeah, it's still incredibly relevant. Others feel we've been witnessing a demise of social media, yeah. and the time of social media has peaked. and Web 3.0 models will take over. Where do you see the role of, for example, Twitter as a medium that is that mainstream medium that actually bridges tribes and brings us together and overcomes polarization?
Yeah. In preparation for this discussion, I thought, what is the definition of media? Do we talk about platforms, which are just tech platforms transporting media and information? Or do we talk about really media where there is a sender, an editorial team, and someone who you could make responsible for what's said? And I would say media is something with an editorial team and you can make responsible for that. And I would make a difference between the platforms and media. Nevertheless, the media are existent on the platforms as journalists themselves, single journalists or single influencer or single audiences, and also as brands. So, and the reason, for example, Twitter is, in my eyes, at least in Germany, a quite close job for expert politicians and journalists. But they discuss what then flows into other channels. So that makes the power of media. And when you talk about the rise and the sunset of social media channels, I think while we are talking today, there might be another social media channel just be invented and grow exponentially.
It might Mastodon,
Look like TikTok, Mastodon, so all the others. It's so fast, and perhaps Facebook is always on its way down. We don't know. But I think social media is here to stay, and there are new channels, new brands, and new technologies, which get a reach in such a fast time. And I think we need to be open to see that, and that's the reason why I say media literacy. And also, when I talk about CEOs and stakeholders, you need to manage the media as one of your most important stakeholders. You need to know which channel to use, how do you use the channel, and how it echoes also. So the media literacy is not just something for the small kids and the usual audience, but for everybody. It's very important.
In a fragmented world, in a polarized world also, we need to talk about the role of truth.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's value in providing truths, as in plural, to various tribes and constituents.
Yeah.
But is there still, do you think it's important to still uphold the importance of one truth? And is it media's responsibility to really insist on that, that there is an objective truth that needs to underpin all of the coverage?
Yeah, I think it's very important that you separate the truth, meaning the fact, from the opinion. And as long as you separate both pillars, I think also the audience is able to make a difference. And you can follow the opinion and you can just witness the facts and say, yes, that's my truth. I will follow another opinion. But the fact is source-based in the end. And the opinion is what someone else is making out of it.
Let's talk about business models.
Yeah.
Because the question is, like, which business models will still be viable in the future for media? So Springer bought Politico, as you mentioned, and Insider, formerly Business Insider. What are some of the business models that you see work and that will work in the future in a fragmented market?
I mean, the business model for journalism is always there and is always vital. And seeing Politico, an Insider, growing on a high margin as a pure digital business model with different revenue sources, subscription revenues, but also advertising revenues, is just great. And there are many, many more examples also outside the Axel Springer world. I mean, if you look at Media Insider, a new media startup founded 2 years ago, 3 years ago in Germany. It's growing fast. It has a voice. It's really making money. So, and that shows that journalism has absolutely a place in the industry and is also there to stay. On the other side, if you look at the legacy business models, the printing business, I call that the publisher's dilemma, because the digitization of a printing business model is really, really difficult. The printing business model is still shrinking, but on a high margin. So it's still more profitable than the digital business model. And at the same time, of course, you try to win subscriber on a digital media, but the subscriber price is lower and the number of subscribers is also lower than in the printing era. So, and then you have the question, how do I finance my editorial team, which was quite big in the print area, but can't be financed in a pure digital era. So that's the reason why I called it the publisher's dilemma, because you need to manage this transformation, but you need to change the business model in the end. It needs to be more digital, but that means also your setup will change, your size will change, your organizational structure will change.
And now we see the advent, of course, of generative AI, which is also talk of the town here in Davos, yes, with the release of ChatGPT, yes, by OpenAI. And you could argue that it's going to fundamentally change the work of journalists, yeah, because in 5 minutes you can now have generative AI, ChatGPT, write an article that would have taken a journalist maybe 5 days or, yeah, or 5 hours.
Yes.
What do you expect to happen? Like, how disruptive is it going to be?
I would say it will be used as a tool within a journalistic space and help to do perhaps repetitive and boring stuff. But the journalist as a curator of the content will always be there, and also as the credible source. And if you look today, if you compare different news sources and even the source they take it from, it's very often a news agency. They take the text. But all in all, it's necessary that there's someone curating this news together. So either as a media menu, a composition, or the text itself, and make something new out of it. Or take it as a base and dig deeper by research. And I think all kind of automation, might be a tool, might be a chat, helps to invest more time in investigation, which is the real foundation for me for journalism. So, yeah.
No, I think because we were playing with ChatGPT and were, yeah, saying, oh my God, we as, yeah, curators, we're safe because precisely for the reasons you just outlined. But then we gave it some prompts that said, propose 10 topics, 10 speakers on the topic of, say, the life-centered economy. And then what ChatGPT actually got back to us,
yeah,
was super impressive.
Yes.
So we actually invited you because it was a human decision, yeah, not ChatGPT.
To be honest, I Googled mine. I tried to get my name in ChatGPT, but they didn't know me. So.
Oh, really? Yes. Okay, interesting.
And then I stopped to use it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, so you see the role of the journalist, yes, as a curator. You see that.
Absolutely.
That continue
and also the example value you just said, get your speakers. It saves you the time to do research, because there is no added value in research. That's something you give to a colleague or to an intern. But the time you have saved, you can use to dig deeper in each profile, to talk to the people, to prepare the setting of a panel. So I don't see it negative, but I see it as a good tool, as an automation in order to focus on the really important stuff.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how AI then also plays into this whole conversation about truth and what we take as objectively,
yes,
true. And one of the debates, particularly I feel in the United States, is always that liberal media, New York Times, for example, is successful and retaining audience because it is confirming their biases.
Yes.
Which is something different than stating the truth or provoking also or opening people's eyes or directing them to other topics. How much room is there for, say, build to actually really challenge the readership rather than just confirming their bias?
Yeah. I mean, confirming the bias was always there. Years ago, the first research was in the 50s, and the result was that people read and consume media along their interests. That's the most important factor of media usage, the interest. But, for example, if you take the news media, general interest media, not special interest, they offer you a range of different topics. And the surprise of opening a newspaper or opening a website and see different articles makes you just using everything and not just along your interest. But you find out, oh, there's something might be interesting, or there's a headline, I should read it. So it opens your mind, in my eyes.
Ulrike, thank you so much for being here with us today. Enjoy the rest of Davos.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.